damn near dead. Luis said that when I took the lead, I didn't pass Sweeney and his pacer on the right, but ran straight between. Did I intentionally try to crush his spirit? Not sure. I can barely remember it. That wasn't exactly the type of ego I was searching for in the woods of Appalachia, though. Perhaps I was asking for too much from my old body and mind, but what I really wanted was a kind of drive, a faith, that would carry me to push beyond what I thought was possible. After Hump Mountain, the going got a lot harder. Long gone were the pine ridges and lofty grassy balds of the Roan Highlands. Now, it was swampy, root-infested rhododendron lowlands of the South's interior. When the weather threw a thunderstorm my way, I was inspired to coin a nickname for my new biome, the Bayou. At least there were no water moccasins or alligators in this bayou. My speed had taken a major hit from the injuries at the end of the first week. I'd gotten in 36 miles on day 9, and I hoped to get to 40 today. It was still mostly walking, but I was optimistic that I could push forward and run for a few miles today. Last night's test run down Roan Mountain had given me a sliver of hope. Maybe my body was remembering something. I couldn't believe that Crazy Horty was right once again. The pain was still there. On day 10, I woke up, if anything, more beaten up than when I'd gone to sleep. But not all pain is the same. Pain can be high or low. It can be deep or shallow. Pain has more than one axis. As I wrestled through the bayou, I checked in with my own pain load. It was increasing in intensity, no question, but decreasing in effect. My pain was getting less painful, which might sound ridiculous, but you'll know what I mean if you routinely push yourself in the gym, or if you have the misfortune to live with a chronic illness or disability. Some of us are familiar with a whole bouquet of pains, each with its own special meaning and impact. Pain is a biological fact, and there's nothing short of drugs that can wipe it away. But we do have some control over how much one fact or another will consume our thoughts and attention. Think about the first date you went on with your current partner, or the night you brought your dog home from the shelter. The love was all-consuming. The world felt like it revolved around your partner or your dog. Do you love him any less than you did then? Of course not. It's just that when affection becomes predictable and routine, it loses its sharpness. And in the case of pain, perhaps the one we know hurts us less than the one we fear. A few things were helping me manage my own pain. The first was the unexpected joy of team father-son. The second was sheer experience. I knew this pain wasn't the end of the world, or the end of my legs, because I had been here before, or close enough to it. The third was based on a kind of faith. I knew I was healing. Well, I didn't know it. I couldn't get an x-ray out there or pull over next to a log and sit down for an MRI. I knew I was healing through the pain because I felt it at a molecular level. It's a kind of gut feeling, a distant but unmistakable sense from a part of your body you have only intermittent communication with. But I'd learned over the years to listen to my body. I could speak its language. Maybe it was pseudoscience. Maybe it was hopeless tautology. I was healing because I felt like I was healing. Maybe it was a placebo effect. It didn't matter to me. It was working. My distance from the finish line also helped, surprisingly. Back in Boulder, I might have predicted the opposite, that the unimaginably long way to go would make the pain more acute by making the journey feel impossible. But that wasn't what happened at all. Instead, I was freed from thinking about the finish line altogether. It remained a faraway thing, an abstraction. My mind didn't have to whirl through calculations about whether or not I could withstand all this punishment for the next X or Y hours. I had to forget about how many hours or days I had left. Why bother calculating? So I thought about the step in front of me, and the step in front of that one. The scope was overwhelming. There was nothing to do but keep going. It was at that moment that another prophecy from the seer of Liberty University echoed in my mind. Before he left, Horty had told Jalu, "Make sure you tell that boy. It never always gets worse." Horty was back home, hundreds of miles away, but his deranged words of twisted wisdom were making guest appearances in my thoughts. It never always gets worse. We'll see. Even if it was going to take a miracle for me to get the record, Jaylu and I still needed to strategize, plan road crossing meetups, set a daily schedule, and keep the battleship running as if we were going to war, and as if the record was still a possibility. I had to fuel my body each day, make sure I was consuming enough calories, grab water at creeks and springs, remember my headlamp for the last stretch of the day. As long as I stayed focused on the small goals, getting to the next road crossing, the next peak, or even the next white blaze, I could continue moving forward. I could keep the FKT within sprinting distance, and I could keep the larger goal, just barely, alive. I forgot about Katahdin being 1,800 miles away, about the FKT, about the loss of normalcy, about everything. I felt how sweet life could be when I wasn't looking at it through a prism of doing, but just being. That was enough for now. It was enough to start running again. I took a few tentative steps, felt the same stabbing pains, and kept going. I was back running. Not elegantly, not with fierceness, not with anything near the speed I'd eventually need, but I was running. If I could just let life happen, everything could work. I didn't have to win, not yet. I just needed to let myself run. Like all epiphanies, that one was great while it lasted. When I wasn't connecting to a cosmic flow, I was stumbling forward and worrying about Jaylu. She had given me so much already. The astonishing capacity for suffering and perseverance she displayed through her miscarriages and subsequent health crises had played a big part in inspiring me to come out here and test myself. I hadn't thought that crewing for me would also be such a bizarre test for her. The guy from the night before, the stalker, had been odd, and I had to assume more weird scenarios were coming. It was no longer just strange. It was scary, especially when I thought about the fact that for the vast majority of time out here, she'd be separated from me. How many more weirdos were out there? How many were prowling around? How many might feel bold enough to mess around with a petite Asian-American woman roaming alone in the backwoods of the Deep South? We'd both noticed the flags down here, but Horty assured us it was a symbol of Southern pride. In other words, a leave-us-alone attitude. But it wasn't just deliverance-inspired paranoia. I'd heard stories from people who'd been here. Former AT record holder, Andrew Trail Dog Thompson, told me about an encounter his buddy Trav had had while thru-hiking the Appalachian Trail in North Carolina. Trav and his friends were hitchhiking on a remote dirt road and desperately needed to get to town for a resupply. After they'd walked toward town for a good bit, a beat-up pickup truck pulled up alongside them, and a scraggly shirtless guy in bib overalls rolled down his window. In classic mountain hillbilly fashion, he growled, "Get in!" Trav and his buddies gave one another the same look, but hospitality is hard to turn down in the South. So they hopped into the truck, Trav and one of his buds in the cab, the other friend in the back. So far, so good. But then, as they were rolling down the road, their chauffeur grabbed a bottle from the floor, took a big swig, and passed the bottle to Trav. He declined, politely. "Thank you, sir, but we've got another 10 miles to do before nightfall." The mountain man insisted. "Take a drink!" Trav declined again. The bearded driver then reached down below his seat, grabbed a .45, and pointed it at Trav. "Now I said, take a drink!" No hesitation this time. Trav took a big tug of the clear liquor, and the driver set down his gun and cackled. He dropped them off where he said that he would, and drove on to find some more drinking buddies, or maybe other thru-hikers to scare shitless. Who knew how many moonshined-up truck drivers were down here? Was he one in a million, or did most trail-adjacent Southerners enjoy pulling handguns on thru-hikers and making them drink from jugs of fiery liquor? As I ran, my thoughts started to spin up and distract me. Everywhere I looked seemed like a good place to stash a body. Sharp turns, dark roads, deserted hollows, forested hills, deep trenches, long gashes in the earth that no one had looked in for centuries, if ever. All these places were populated by my imagination, with fresh corpses and their murderers. But when the anxious spell passed, I realized that I could relate to the men and women down here. Peel away a few choice decals, furl up a flag or two, and they weren't that different from the folks I'd grown up around in rural Minnesota. Long, hard stares from dead-end road inhabitants, and a don't-tread-on-me mentality existed everywhere in this country, and most of them would probably have politely helped a damsel in distress with a flat tire. At least that's what I told myself. I know now, with a little less on my mind, and a little more distance from these events, that most of the people we ran into were almost certainly good, kind, hospitable people who were far more likely to lend a hand than bite one off. In fact, that part of the trail is particularly known among AT hikers for its southern hospitality. Aside from the crazy local guide who seemed to be tracking Jenny, and old Trav's chauffeur, the locals in the south were wonderful, especially at some of the cafes near the trail where Jalu politely asked if they would cook my home fries in oil, not butter or lard. Still, night 10, we huddled up extra close as we grabbed a few hours of sleep in Castle Black at Dennis Cove Road. It was clear that we wouldn't be able to run together in the morning every day like we'd planned to. The big problem was Castle Black. Who would drive it? Who would be there with our belongings if the two of us ran? When it was just Jalu and me out on the trail, she was often tethered to that fortress. So we developed new traditions, one of which, making border crossings together, became a favorite. On day 11, we were poised to leave Tennessee and enter Virginia. Right across the border was another milestone, the town of Damascus, a classic trail town that treated hikers well. But fate intervened on the trail to Damascus. It arrived in the form of a text message, a shock in its own right, considering how rare cell service was on that section of the trail. As soon as I recognized the message's sender, I stopped dead in my tracks. I had no idea what it might contain, but I knew it'd be worth a read. If you get this, and maybe you have thought of it, but the northbound record is still easily in reach, keep rolling. Great to follow progress. You are doing great. Carl Speed Goat Meltzer had made his first appearance on my journey north, and it was classic Speed Goat. Behind that veneer of support was the implication that I might, still be able to get the other record, the one for a northbounder. The challenge, like a chiropractic manipulation, snapped my head back on straight. I disagreed. I could still get the overall FKT, which I told him. I texted, "Thanks, dude. Nobo? I've still got the Sobo in sights. Putting in 50 today. Should be in Damascus by dark. Quad is coming around. I'll walk the record if I need to." Speed Goat, "Cool. Just keep your head in it. You'll be fine." When Palmer went north, he walked the first 1,000 miles. Did not run a step. Me, "Cool. Thanks, dude. Good beta. I'm able to run a bit today, so we'll see. Jenny will touch base to see if you want to still come out. Can get you a ticket." Speak up. "I'm still game. I'm working in aid station this weekend. Have Jenny call me Monday. Keep moving." Here's the thing. If anyone had come across me hiking and hobbling toward Damascus and asked what I thought my chances were for the FKT, I would have been more than cautious. I wouldn't have advised putting a single cent on me, despite El Coyote's advice, never bet against the champ. But Speed Goat challenging me from somewhere far away? Implying it was already game over? I knew the AT speed record was his baby, and I'm sure he was concerned I might scoop it from him. Was he trying to mess with me? Or was he just serving reality straight up like the emotionless old goat always did? His glib prediction set my jaw. I would still get the FKT. Southbound, northbound, whatever and however bound. I would claw and crawl all day, every day, to Katahdin, if I had to. I had needed some ego fire starter, and I had desperately needed hope. The speed goat gave me both. That evening, as darkness consumed the woods, I backtracked half a mile with Jenny so that together we could touch the sign welcoming us to Virginia.
Jerker was still gimpy. He was moving slowly, but at least he was making progress north, and that was all I cared about. Friends back home were texting me things like, "Hope he gets back to putting in 50-mile days soon," but I wasn't sure that would happen. His injuries weren't healing as quickly as he was used to, but such is the curse of aging. Or maybe it was the curse of the AT speed record and the insane daily mileage. However, things were getting easier for me. I had finally gotten into a groove. I'd established some systems and routines for Castle Black and had a handle on crewing this juggernaut trail. The bugs and humidity didn't even faze me. I was adapting. I hadn't grown up in an outdoorsy family, but I always felt safe in the mountains. In Seattle, I would drive up to the Cascades after work and run an 18-mile loop by myself. I'd often finish past dark. A lot of my runs back then were done in the evening rain, alone with my thoughts and my music. I figured that if I came across other people out there, they'd be my people. Runners, hikers, and creatives just needing some fresh air or looking to clear their minds. Before Jerker, I'd never dated a runner. I was used to running alone. But even so, with Horty and El Coyote gone and Jerker out on the trail almost all day, I had a lot more alone time than I needed. I missed my friends back home. My meetups with Jerker became my only social hour. We would sit on the floor of Castle Black for 30 minutes, eat lunch, and catch up on news headlines. He always wanted to hear about what was going on in the outside world. It was hard for him to leave the van and our sliver of normalcy, and it was hard for me to kick him out and send him back into the woods, leaving me with endless errands and my only friends, a Bluetooth speaker and an electric fan. They kept me company like Tom Hanks's Wilson in Castaway. All those hours on the trail allowed Jerker's mind to wander a little too much. One afternoon, after I'd spent the day chasing down frozen fruit for his smoothies, he appeared out of the woods, approached Castle Black, and said, "Hey, can you call Norm and ask him to mow our lawn? And then can you email our electrician? I think he overcharged us for the solar panel installation on the van." "Okay, in all my spare time, I'll be sure to do those things. Right after I get gas, drain the water from the cooler, refill it with ice, wash the dishes, drive to the next spot, make dinner, and wait without cell service for your sorry ass." Then, as he sipped his smoothie, he said, "This is good, thank you. But you know what sounds really good? Thai food." I laughed to keep myself from strangling him. I realized that he had no idea about my reality. His perception of what I did while he was inching his way up the trail was nothing like what actually happened. On the morning we left Damascus, local trail runners JJ and Beth offered to crew for Scott, which I was nervous about. I didn't really trust strangers to crew for him. Our entire trip relied on the crew being where it was supposed to be when he got there. But Jerker was so excited. "Enjoy your morning off," he said to me as the three of them left. It was a nice idea, but I think he thought I was going to sleep in, eat breakfast in a restaurant, maybe even catch up with friends, check out the town some. Instead, I did 2 loads of laundry, cleaned and organized the van, called Norm about our lawn, we were ticketed for it being overgrown, and got groceries and gas. Then I made my way up to Grayson Highlands State Park. Horty had told me I had to go there and check out the wild ponies. I waited a long time near the ponies, lying on the grass and watching them graze. Then I started to worry, so I hiked up the trail. I went 2 miles before I finally saw them. Jerker was moving so slowly that I felt bad for his gracious local companion, Beth. I guess I could have slept in after all. Even though I was most comfortable in the mountains, I wasn't actually in the mountains. It would be one thing if I was out on the trail. I knew I could outrun or out-karate chop any assailant. I had heard too many stories from friends whose cars had been broken into at trailhead parking lots. Trailheads are magnets for petty thieves. I felt safer in the trees. But I was stuck in a well-marked van on the side of a dirt road or in a tiny parking area. I had so much to get done at each meeting spot that when my chores were finished, all I wanted to do was take a nap, and I just had to hope that nobody would try to break in. Sketchy cars occasionally pulled up, and strangers tried to talk to me, and I started to resent Jerker for being so slow, for leaving me stranded out there alone. I had never spent any time in the South, so I had no sense of place, no connection to the community. I'd heard stories of murders on the AT not too far north from where we were, and while everybody knew where Scott was at all times, I didn't have a GPS tracker on me. I could end up in some ditch and nobody would find me for days or ever. On day 11, as Jerker was running, I was having a particularly hard time finding the road that would take me to our next meeting spot. When I finally found the little trailhead lot, I was surprised to see several cars already there, but that meant there'd be hikers around, which made things safer. I parked Castle Black, got out, and opened the back doors to look for Jerker's headlamp. I knew he was going to come in late, and he didn't have his headlamp, so I was planning on running back with the light to meet him. As I walked around the van, I felt the creepy sensation of eyes on me. I scanned the parking lot full of cars and saw a dirty white sedan with somebody sitting in the driver's seat. The door was partly open. I tried not to look, but he was full-on staring at me. The dust on the windshield obscured my view of him, but from what I could tell, he didn't look like a hiker. He could have passed for Jerry Garcia's feral brother. I looked around and saw that all the other cars were unoccupied. It was just the two of us in that trailhead parking lot. I got back in the van and locked the doors. Now I was in a pickle. If I ran down the trail to bring Jerker his headlamp, the grateful gawker might break into our home on wheels and find a lot of nice comforts. But if I stayed, who knew what might happen to me? I glanced over at my side mirror, and yep, there he was, still staring. I weighed my options. I decided that Jerker needed me and that this guy looked too fat to actually run after me. So I jumped out of the van, slammed the door, locked it, and ran as fast as I could up the trail. I kept looking behind to see if he was following me. Once I'd gone some distance, I stopped to see if I could hear him breaking a window or anything like that. Nothing, so far. I was less than a mile down the trail when I saw Jerker. A huge relief. Big Thump was gonna thump down on Shakedown Street. Jerker, there's a creepy guy in the parking lot sitting in his car, and he kept staring at me and casing Castle Black. I was out of breath and distracted, but I noticed that Jerker was moving well and at a good pace. I felt like he might mess with me or the van. Jerker bolted down the trail so fast I could barely keep up, but when we got to the parking lot, the guy was gone. At least for the moment.
Chapter 7. Southern Hospitality. Day 11. I was feeling good. Not based on my injuries, but based on the AT terrain and tread. I was actually running again. I was easing my way down the gentle slope of trail to the parking lot. Daylight was waning, but I still had plenty of light. Good thing, since I'd forgotten to grab my headlamp at the last meetup with Jalu. I was planning to run another 8 miles, which meant I'd finish up around 10 o'clock. A good day all in all. Back on track, back on schedule. Then I saw someone running toward me. It was Jalu, and she was waving her arms wildly, like someone flagging down a cop car. When she got near enough, she immediately started telling me what was wrong. It was some creep again. I'd had it. I ran on ahead as fast as I could. When I got to the parking lot, he was gone, and Castle Black was intact. But it didn't matter. I was pissed and physically drained. I decided to call it a day and forget the next section. I could bang that out in the morning. we'd sleep here tonight. I didn't want Jaylu driving around alone that evening and waiting at yet another dirt road crossing for 2 hours. She told me she was fine, that I should keep going, but I was done. I decided right then and there to stop sending her to remote and sketchy places alone, day or night. I would start doing longer stretches without support, 20 to 25 miles at a time, and we'd meet only at paved road crossings. No more creepy encounters. The next day, I woke up at 5 a.m. I'd been feeling stiff and achy in the mornings, but that day I cranked out the 8-mile section in 2 hours. I was running, listening to music, carrying a running vest that held food and a hydration bladder with an inline mini water filter. I felt in my element. I could have been on a long training run in the peaks back home. By the time I got to the next meetup, a gas station near an Interstate 81 overpass, I had finished 32 miles, and it wasn't even noon yet. Jaylu seemed surprised to see me so early. She had taken a nap in a nearby restaurant parking lot and had just gotten to the gas station. "Jerker!" She jumped out of the van to greet me. "Hey, you're early. You'll never guess what just happened. I was looking for a place to park when a red beat-up car pulls up to the van. This old dude asks, 'What time did Scott get in last night?' I was thinking to myself, 'Who the hell is this, and what is he talking about?' I thought maybe he was some superfan who wanted a live update, but he didn't look like a runner or even somebody who owned a computer. Then I took a closer look at his face. Same scraggly beard, same disheveled look. Different vehicle, but it could only be him. The guy from last night. 'No way, are you sure?' I looked around the parking lot to see if he was still there. 100%, I'm positive. I figured out who he was. The grateful gawker in the broad daylight looked exactly like the guy who trolls your Facebook page. Warren Doyle? Yes. I laughed and sat down on the edge of the van. That guy had been talking trash about me while I was on the trail. The other day, I'd caught up to two thru-hikers who were surprised to see me. They said, "We didn't know you were still out here. Warren Doyle said that you were done, that your leg was injured. Said this wasn't going to be your year." Of course he told him that. Warren liked to position himself as the gatekeeper of the Appalachian Trail. And for some reason, he had a serious bone to pick with trail runners. He loved to try to pit the hikers against us. During Speed Goat's record attempts, he'd really laid into him online. It was like he had a personal vendetta against the runners on the trail. He proclaimed on his website that walking the entire Appalachian Trail is not recreation. It is an education and a job. Okay, Warren, but not everybody wants to walk. Let people choose their own speed. Horty had said, "I've got my spies on the AT." And now I knew who he was referring to. But Warren seemed to take spying to another level. He probably was out here making sure that I wasn't cheating, that I wasn't faking it. After all, we weren't just visitors in Warren's world. He represented one special section of AT obsessives whose earnest love for the place had curdled over the years into a sense of possession. It was palpable online and on the trail. Forget checking to see if I was cheating. He probably had a laundry list of arbitrary trail rules, and he was keeping track of the ones I broke, like a self-appointed AT hall monitor. Some people loved him. Jaylu and I met part of his group, and they were having a great time with him. To be fair, you couldn't ask for a better guide. Warren had hiked the AT more than anyone else, an astonishing 18 times and counting. And Horty was friends with him, so who knew? But he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Just minutes after Jaylu's encounter with Warren, a thru-hiker asked her what the trail was like up ahead. She told him, "I'm not really sure, sorry. But Warren Doyle is right there, you could ask him." And the hiker rolled his eyes and moved his hand like he was spanking the monkey. I appreciated Warren's monitoring of record attempts, and I welcomed the scrutiny. But the manner in which he carried out that monitoring crossed a line. He could have introduced himself to Jaylu. She would have been happy to answer any questions and show him whatever proof he was looking for. It's one thing to post crap on social media, and it's another thing to spread rumors on the trail to fellow thru-hikers. But nobody spooks my wife. On the climb up near Walker Mountain, as fire hoses of water sprayed down from the black clouds and thunder boomed, I spotted a figure covered by an old-school poncho. The only thing visible was a long, grizzled beard with rain rivulets gushing through it. Some might take him for a character in Murder on the Appalachian Trail. There was no mistaking him. "Are you Warren Doyle?" I shouted through the driving rain and thunder. "Yes, I am," he said, a bit surprised. I got up in his face. "You don't need to be spying on me. I'm covering every single inch of this trail and being completely transparent. If you question my integrity, you ask me directly. Don't just sit in your car and freak out my wife. Next time I'll have state troopers on your ass." He mumbled something in the pouring down rain. I raged on. "I thought you folks down here celebrated decency and etiquette. Whatever happened to Southern hospitality?" By day 12, I was only a fifth of the way to Katahdin, but I felt like I'd run the gauntlet already. I'd hit a towering wall, and a text message had catapulted me over it. I'd nearly given up in a motel in Irwin, but I'd gotten out and walked it off. My legs were feeling better, somehow, and I was beginning to remember what it felt like to be racing out ahead of the pack. I was outrunning my doubts for the first time, and I was back to doing 50-mile days. It wasn't all roses and runner's highs. I was also thinking about getting Jenny a handgun. It was a ridiculous thought. I knew she'd never touch a gun. But after 12 days, I was finding it impossible to ignore the darker side of the AT, the side that only slowly exposes itself to committed hikers and AT history buffs. When we arrived at the quintessential trail town of Damascus back on day 10, we drove through the little downtown. There were posters still up from the Trail Days Festival, which is like the Woodstock of the AT community. We had just missed it, and all the drama that surrounded it a few days prior. Apparently, the FBI had arrested James Hamis, a 53-year-old man who had been a resident thru-hiker on this section for the past 4 years, a contributor to the AT Guide, and a regular guest at the Damascus boarding house where the FBI found him. Hamis, known to most by his trail name Bismarck, sported an unruly beard and seemed to fit in well with the AT crowd. What none of us knew was that the FBI had interviewed him back in 2009 in Ohio about the embezzlement of $8.7 million from the company he'd worked for. That was when he'd disappeared from Ohio. He wasn't the first hiker to use the AT as a place to hide out. The trail has the same attraction to wanderers as rail cars used to have in the Old West, a kind of permanent itinerancy, a place to go where you could just keep going for as long as you liked. Jalu and I both had experienced that pull and wanderlust. We just didn't pair it with evading authorities. Certainly, there are some scoundrels among those who wander the trail, but there are redemption stories as well. For instance, David Lesko. Back in 2005, David Lesko started hiking south from Rhode Island. Along the way, he got into the habit of stealing other campers' food and gear. Then he came upon a trail angel in New Jersey. David didn't need to steal from the angel because he freely offered him dinner, a warm bed, and a hot shower. Then he showed David a video featuring born-again Christian celebrity Kirk Cameron. Apparently, the video took because the two men prayed together, and David got religion and swore to make amends to those he'd harmed. The angel gave him some money, and David kept heading south, mailing letters of apology, cash, and stolen equipment back to those he'd stolen from. He changed his trail name from Injun to Saved, the name he was known by when the law enforcement caught him stealing food and gear from a cabin just south of Damascus. So in that case, the redemption was temporary. Temporary also describes how things are on the AT and in towns like Damascus. The trail has something for everyone, peace, nature, and a chance to get away from it all. But this Eden has endpoints. And sometimes things get nasty. Sometimes it's the fault of the locals, like the fishhook booby traps Horty told us of. But hiker misbehavior was more typical, and we weren't immune to it. With my partner logos on Castle Black, the van was often mistaken for a company promotional vehicle. Some thru-hikers grabbed Cliff Bars out of the back one day as Jaylee was unpacking, and then even worse, left the wrappers scattered all over the trail. If petty theft and littering were the highest crimes on the AT, it'd be pretty much like any other parkland in the United States. But unfortunately, there have been far more serious offenses. 11 people have been murdered along the AT since 1974. Randall Lee Smith brutally killed a thru-hiking couple in 1981. He was convicted of second-degree murder, sent to prison, and paroled 15 years later, and he promptly tried to kill two more people on the trail. In 2007, a Georgia couple named John and Irene Bryant disappeared while they were on a hike not too far from Damascus. And the next year, a 24-year-old hiker named Meredith Emerson also vanished. Later, their bodies were found. Some of the killings have never been solved. People disappear on the trail. Perhaps some of them intended to. Hence my idea about a gun. The murders were rare, but by the time we crossed over into Virginia, I'd heard enough disturbing stories from Jaylee that I'd had to recalibrate a bit. I knew a professional female climber who kept a Glock in her van's glove box. Jaylee didn't even have a can of mace. The Appalachian Trail was a path toward higher consciousness and a test of character, but it was also a wild, lawless place. I called my buddy Rick, who lived out in the California desert and served as an EOD Navy diver. We discussed the possibility of him accompanying Jaylee through Virginia. I wanted him to protect her and asked if he could pack some heat. Luckily, I came to my senses, high up on a spine of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Well, my good judgment was helped by the fact that Rick wasn't able to come out. There'd be no gun and no backup for my friend. But still, I stuck to my decision to stop having Jaylee meet me at backwoods road crossings, where she would have to hang out alone in the wilderness for long stretches. I would meet her at major roadways, with numbers and pavement. No more remote dirt roads. That was tough for both of us, and it meant 15 to 25 mile stretches for me and fewer stops for food. After all the strange encounters, I was freaked out and kicking myself for thinking that Jaylee would be fine on her own. Why didn't I make sure we at least had one friend with Jaylee at all times? Man, I could be an idiot. It was an anxious time for me, but it was also, frankly, mind-numbing. The AT in Virginia is deceptively punishing. It's hot and sticky when you're heading up, rocky and root-filled when you're going down, and seemingly endless. Thru-hikers call it the Virginia Blues because the trail meanders 554 miles through the state. In fact, Virginia is home to nearly a quarter of the entire AT, and there are multiple rubble-laden mountains riddling those miles. The Smokies might officially end in Tennessee, but the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia are their formidable step-siblings. Many of the 4,000-foot peaks had foreboding monikers. Bruiser's Knob, Dragon's Tooth, Buzzard's Rock, the Guillotine, and the Priest. Fittingly, this range was Horty's playground. As I climbed those mountains, I recalled many of their names from his training stories and tall tales. The beginning of the Virginia Blues also marks the beginning of a surprisingly sadistic stretch of the trail itself. The AT becomes increasingly gnarly and demanding as it twists through the Virginia Appalachians, inspiring a witticism I'd heard plenty by the time I got through the state. Question: which is better, taking your chances with the rocks or taking your chances with the roots? Answer: which is better, being hanged or being shot? My injuries were slowly healing up, as Horty had predicted they eventually would. Physically, I was feeling strong, but the midday heat and the repetitious terrain lulled me to sleep. I started taking power naps on rocks and leaves off the trail, anywhere I could lie down, and I got pretty good at it. One time, I spooked a few hikers who were cautiously inspecting me, afraid I was dead. I would have loved to sleep 8 hours a night and not have to take naps that interrupted my progress. I would have loved to hang out at campfires, kicking back with all the colorful characters who decided to spend a summer of their lives ambling through the wilderness. I would have loved to hear more stories about the weird history of the trail, its many eccentrics, from the dangerous maniacs to the gentle souls. There were opportunities to kick back, there were plenty of temptations. A few days after we'd passed Damascus, Jaylu met a young group of thru-hikers who told her they were having a big hiker party next to Dismal Falls and they really wanted me to join them. Jaylu immediately told them I would attend. She knew me well. I knew it would cut into my sleep, but I wanted to hang out and meet more of my clan. It was pouring rain and near dark when I got there, but I had a beer while a dozen or so half-naked hikers danced in the river by the falls. One guy wearing only boxer briefs held a kid's pink umbrella and pranced on the rocks, unfazed by the rain. They were forest nymphs in their natural habitat. As I made my way back to the trail, I thought about the differences between the AT and the long trails out west that I knew so much better. The Appalachian Trail is by far the most social of the three mega trails in the United States, just by dint of being in a place where there are a whole lot of people. Population density is a lot higher in Virginia than in Colorado, and while the trail can feel like a wilderness, it's almost always a short walk or a hitch to a town. Some hikers even call it the world's largest pub crawl. Others are no doubt disappointed by this. They arrive with a mental picture of isolated landscape, but quickly learn that contact is the norm. It would have been fun to hang out more and not think about mileage quotas or an itinerary, the way we traveled on the PCT, but we would get back to that later. This time, it was about pursuing that edge. I covered 51.6 miles on day 14 and made my way over Angel's Rest and Senator Shumate Bridge in Parisburg. I finished that night in a haze of deja vu. I could have sworn I was walking in circles. I found myself on Mountain Lake Road in the middle of nowhere at 11 p.m. Sketchy trucks had slowly driven past Jaylu as she waited for me to arrive. I was hours late. The next day, I hiked over Lone Pine Peak, past the 300-year-old Kefir Oak, the largest oak tree on the AT in the south, went up Dragon's Tooth, and made it just shy of McAfee Knob, all the while picking my way over softball-sized rocks that were hidden among the roots and ground cover of the overgrown trail. I'd covered another 46 miles by the time I closed out the 15th day. I survived the early Virginia blues in the most tedious manner possible. By staying focused. No secret, no superpower. Miles became a moving meditation.
We were a quarter of the way through the Appalachian Trail. It was hard to believe we'd made it this far, and even harder to imagine how much farther we had to go. We hadn't crossed a state line in a long time, which made the next 1,600 miles seem impossible to cover. It was easier to think of the trail in bite-sized pieces represented by each state. Progress was just less tangible in Virginia. It felt like we were spinning our wheels and going nowhere. Yet in 12 days, Jerker had covered so much ground that we were catching up to more and more company. Traditionally, northbound AT thru-hikers depart from Springer Mountain at the end of March or the beginning of May. Most of the people we met were just out of college. We felt old, but at the same time, it was inspiring to be around these adventurous kids. I knew Jerker would get a boost from meeting more hikers out here. When I drove through Marion, Virginia, the first big town I'd seen, I jumped at the chance to stop at a Walmart. Out here in rural southwestern Virginia, the store seemed like an oasis. I loaded up on plant-based protein sources, organic fruit, and a lot of Jerker's favorite vegan treats. He'd been going through them at an alarming rate. Normally a whole grain, low-fat, healthy eater, out here he was all about oily, high-fat, sugary junk food. It was almost scary. He could drink an entire pint of melted vegan ice cream in one gulp. In the fabric department at Walmart, I bought a couple of yards of tulle to use as a makeshift screen for the van's sliding door to keep the bugs out. Hands down, the best $2 I ever spent. When I returned to the van with my treasures, there was a fluorescent green note stuck to the windshield. It read, "Good luck, Scott Jurek. See you out on the trail. Best wishes, Cujo, Sam, and Sarah. No trail name yet." It was simple but so sweet. Not only was he catching up to the thru-hikers, but some of them were rooting for him, and that meant a lot to me. He had been spending more and more hours alone in the confining green tunnel, running through cobwebs and occasionally listening to music. Without others around to take turns driving the van, I could only run short out-and-back sections with him. I could tell he was missing the company. I certainly was getting lonely. Our haphazard trip planning and our desire to be alone meant that most of our friends hadn't even known we were on the AT until we started. By the time we were in the belly of Virginia and realized we could both benefit from some friendly company, it was too late to ask anyone to join us. Nearly everyone had already made summer plans. A few friends offered to come out and pay Scott, but I couldn't tell them where we would be or even what airport to fly into on any particular day. Plus, they'd have to find a ride to meet me on the trail. Our friends were a resourceful bunch, but they were way too busy to seek a needle in a haystack on their days off. Then, out of the blue, I got a text from Jen Shelton. She was at a race in Arkansas that Luis happened to be photographing. Luis, Jen, and Scott were part of the original ragtag group in Born to Run. They were family. El Coyote mentioned to Jen that he was flying straight from Arkansas back to the AT. Jen immediately asked if she could come with him. For some reason, he said no. Not being one to take no seriously, she texted me. I wrote back. What? You want to come out to the AT? And Luis said no? Is he high? I was annoyed. I think Luis was trying to protect me. He knew I had my hands full out here. But I'd never say no to Jen Shelton. I knew she was just what Jerker needed. Not quite a balm for his soul. More like rubbing alcohol in a wound. It stings, but you know that means it's working. Last summer, Jerker and I flew out to support Jen on her John Muir Trail FKT attempt. Jerker surprised her near Red's Meadow in the morning and ran with her through the night. Somehow, the two of them managed to forget some essentials. Jerker left behind all his warm clothes, and Jen neglected to bring any food. So the two of them came rolling into Tuolumne Meadows, famished, with Scott wearing a space blanket around his legs like a skirt. They were quite the pair. Not exactly a dream team, but always laughing and pushing each other. I told Jen to get here however she could, even if it meant stowing away in El Coyote's monster backpack. We needed her. She changed her flights, and I felt a huge wave of relief knowing that Jerker would have some colorful company in the hot, humid hills of Virginia, not far from where Jen grew up. This morning would be my last day alone, so I wanted to tidy up. I pulled into an empty gas station with a huge gravel parking lot and positioned Castle Black in the far end where I could clean and organize the van in peace. I wasn't doing it for Jen, but for Luis, Mr. Neat Freak. I was happily in my zone, listening to music and washing the dishes, so I didn't notice the truck approaching until it pulled in right next to the passenger side. Weird. This was a huge, empty parking area, and there was no one out here, except for me. I turned off my music. Knock, knock, knock. Their truck was idling. I slid the van door open. There were three young guys, apparently locals. I assumed they had spotted the van and were fans of Scott. The one who seemed to be their ringleader piped up. Hey, you're looking good this morning, the blonde guy said. Can I get my picture taken with you? I paused, then said, sure, I guess. I tried to laugh it off. Maybe they'd never seen an Asian lady before, and I was about to be a joke shared with their friends. I didn't care. I just wanted them to leave. I posed with the blonde guy while one friend took a photo and the other friend walked around Castle Black. He pointed at my license plate. You're from Colorado, huh? Got any weed in there? I got it. They weren't running super fans. They thought I was transporting drugs in a black van with no windows. I laughed again. No weed, just running shoes. My husband is running the Appalachian Trail, and I'm supporting him. He should be here soon, so I better get ready. The guys seemed to take the hint, and they got back in their truck. It was still idling. I quickly got back in the van and checked my phone. I had one bar of cell service. I didn't bother finishing the dishes. I cracked the sliding door open and poured the water onto the pavement. Just as I finished, a hand from outside slid the door wide open. It was the blonde guy again, and he was alone. His two friends were in the idling vehicle, and now I started to worry. Who the hell did he think he was to open my van door? "Hey, that photo didn't turn out good. Can I get another photo?" he asked with a smile. A thought creeped into my head, a line from the movie The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. At one point, the villain says, "It's hard to believe that the fear of offending can be stronger than the fear of pain. But you know what? It is." I didn't want to assume the worst about these guys, and I didn't want to offend them. I posed for an awkward selfie with the blonde guy. He looked over the photo and approved. I got back in the van and slammed the sliding door shut as loud as possible. This time I wasn't afraid to offend. I saw another truck pull into the gas station. The blonde guy walked up to the driver and pointed in my direction. Now the guys in the other truck were all staring. Who knows what they were saying, what they were plotting. I started the engine and peeled out of there as fast as I could. Thankfully, nobody followed me. I made my way to the next trail crossing, where I was surprised to see the orange Honda Element with Horty sitting on the tailgate. He was on his way to start his bike ride, but he'd made a side trip to drop off Luis and see Jerker again. But where was Jen? Apparently, the airline had canceled her connecting flight. I was crushed. I needed some female energy, but I would settle for good old El Coyote. Not long after I arrived, Jerker came running in with a few local runners in tow. He was moving great, the best I'd seen him do in days. It was early but already hot and humid, so we all jumped in the creek to cool off. Jerker thanked his local companions, and then we headed off on the trail while Horty walked with us. Luis followed along, snapping some photos, but turned back quickly. He was going to drive the van so I could run the next stretch alone with Jerker. Horty followed us up the switchbacks. I wasn't sure why he'd gone out of his way to pick up Luis and drop him off on the trail, adding to his already long drive out west. But I think he wanted to get his eyes on Jerker, to gauge for himself how he was holding up. Jerker was enjoying Horty's company, but it was slowing him down. He went from running at a great pace to walking. Horty was rattling off a bunch of stats, telling Jerker what he could expect to see in the next few days and giving some trail-worn advice. "Hey, you guys got the right attitude. You're really embracing the trail and the other hikers. Doyle always asked me, but how's his head? I think he's hoping you'll crack like Carl." Horty looked Jerker in the eye. "I told him your head is right where it needs to be. I think you're going to get that record." We said our goodbyes and wished Horty luck, and after a few minutes of running, Jerker and I were alone. I could tell Jerker was pleased with how well he was recovering from his injuries. He was almost giddy with his running progress. He was fired up by all the naysayers, the Warren Doyles commenting online and saying he was done. He told me, "Jalu, I'm going to show them. I'm going to crank this out in under 40 days. I followed his footsteps in silence. I was happy he was so confident. "All I care about is that we're back in time for my birthday." He laughed. "Oh, don't worry. We're going to finish this on the 4th of July and be back by the 8th. My birthday was July 12th, so at least he was giving himself somewhat of a cushion. It seemed doable, but we would need to hustle. I got on his case. "Just try not to waste too much time talking to people." I could tell I'd touched a nerve. Very calmly and full of conviction, he said, "Jalu, if it comes down to hours, then you can get mad at me." Famous last words.
Chapter 8. Nickels and Dimes. Day 16. I woke up in a daze, rolled over, looked through the windshield, and saw a dozen runners milling about outside the walls of Castle Black. I slid open the door to go do my morning business. A running group from Roanoke would be joining me on the way to picturesque McAfee Knob. It was becoming my new routine. Smile, greet, talk, run. Jenny and I had come to the AT with visions of the two of us, mostly alone, out in the elements. But after 700 miles, the trip had become something else entirely. Our journey was taking on a life of its own. Perhaps I had let it happen. Perhaps I should have drawn stricter boundaries. That's not to suggest it was all bad, because it wasn't. Not by a long shot. We were positively impacted by others, and could tell they were inspired by the breadth of our joyous struggle. Even as it became routine, I never stopped being amazed that people made such an effort to find us, support us, help us, run with us. That's what makes the AT one of the most magical trails on the planet. I loved the feeling of running in the world and with the world. I didn't want to be locked into the green tunnel all by myself, chasing some abstraction. Still, we had a record to set. I knew I should have taken a couple of quick pics with the group and then headed out, but I ended up spending 30 minutes there taking photos and enjoying their company. It's a beautiful setting, and if you know people who've hiked that part of the AT, they'll almost certainly have pictures from there. It's one of the most photographed landmarks along the whole 2,200 miles. As I posed for photos and chatted, Jalu started encouraging me to get going. I was spending too much time talking. She was right. Last night had been another late finish. It was nearly midnight when I'd finally stopped. I was moving well again after my injuries, but the miles were taking longer than they had when I'd first started out. The late nights were tough on Jalu, too. She had to wait up for me, which meant she was getting the same 5 hours of sleep I was. There was no question. I needed to be more efficient. Before we left, Jalu found a trio of Fleet Feet Sports Roanoke locals to accompany me for the next 15 rough and remote miles. She seemed to be saying that if I was going to socialize, at least I could do it on the go. We shared vegan wraps and burritos they'd brought. Sharing a meal is one of my favorite things, even if I have to do it on my feet. It was a mobile smorgasbord of lunch, laughs, and musings on current events and the new season of Game of Thrones, which I was missing. The pop culture conversations gave me a funny feeling. They brought me back to the real world while simultaneously reminding me of how very far away from it I had gotten. Perspective is always enlightening. In the afternoon, my new running buddies disconnected from my northbound train and wished me well. I wanted to follow them. The humidity had just descended on the Virginia woods like a hot, wet blanket, and I was wilting. It was the kind of humidity that's wicked into your bones and drags you down from the inside out. While I was making my way through an exposed stretch of the trail that carved through a mowed and manicured field, I decided to take a walking break. I needed to get my mind off the elements, so I pulled my phone out and checked the comments on my most recent Facebook post. Jalu had told me that there were a lot of remarks, and I needed a distraction. I didn't get quite what I was looking for. One of the first messages I saw was from my mom's sister. "Your mother would be so proud of you," was all it said. I found my eyes welling up with tears. I was totally alone and exposed in the middle of a Virginia field, and a deep sadness gripped me in a matter of seconds. My emotional defenses must have melted down in the heat. I'd begun to notice that same phenomenon in other, less dramatic moments. In the course of 2.5 weeks of running, I felt like my physical senses were increasingly finely tuned. I was becoming an intuitive animal. At the same time, my emotional equilibrium was tipping way out of whack, which had happened before. When you're pursuing hard challenges, emotions rise to the surface, and I was so much more